Hi, this is Brian Michael Bendis, writer of Ultimate Spider-Man, and you are listening to Nerd Culture Podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 23 of the Nerd Culture Podcast. My name is David, and with me are the NCP crew. Richo.
Where I come from, no woman is complete without a man.
Luke.
You must have some, you know, mighty fine jigsaw women then.
Well, that was clever. I only just got that. And Crystal.
That is correct. His name is David.
Okay. Thank you for that assurance. I forgot. I didn't know if it actually was David or not. Nerd Culture Podcast is a fortnightly Australian podcast that focuses on nerd culture-related film, book, and comic reviews with a healthy dose of opinion thrown in for good measure. Not only do we have the podcast, we also have our website at
www.nerdculturepodcast.com,
which features additional content not found on the podcast itself. This episode is going to be all about the Avengers. The crew just went and saw the Avengers movie a couple of days ago. It was released here a good 2 weeks before the States.
Yeah, take that, America.
And England, where for some reason it's called Avengers Assemble.
Yeah, take that, England.
That sounds like a Transformer bot. Avenger Assemble.
Well, that is their battle cry, but they renamed it because they thought people would be a bit confused with the Avengers TV show, which is very
yeah, they wonder why,
British.
You know, Pat, why Steed and Appeal weren't fighting Loki.
I'm pretty sure they can tell the difference between a movie and
God,
a TV
show. God,
it'd
be awesome if they had cameos.
Yeah, do you really want to see, you know, Ralph Fiennes and Uma Thurman in the background somewhere?
Diana Rigg should have been Maria Hill. Not that chick from How I Met Your Mother or whatever.
Jenny Agutter's in it. Speaking of British people.
Is she really? Where?
Yeah. I think she's the woman that's on the screen with Powers Booth. You know, the different...
Oh, okay.
I'm pretty sure that's
The conglomerate.
Yeah.
I think the pentaveret.
The pentaveret!
Ooh, I hated Colonel Sanders.
The Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, and Colonel Sanders!
Ooh, you gotta eat my chicken. Anyway, moving on. So a popcorn junkie on the Avengers movie, and then a roundtable on the Avengers comics. Our favourite team lineups and stories and a brief history of the Avengers in comics. Crystal, are you going to be able to stay awake during that?
Just occasionally say the word Captain America, Thor or Iron Man, you'll be fine.
Just throw it in every now and again.
I saw the movie.
Yeah, that is true.
My advice for those who are not comic fans, at least stick around for the movie review because it's, I enjoyed it, so you may too.
That's good to hear. So first up, Popcorn Junkie, The Avengers. Okay, the NCP crew just got back from watching The Avengers, and now we're going to give you our opinions. So The Avengers, the latest in Marvel Studios' grand plan of films. It's, of course, it's the follow-up from their previous superhero films, Iron Man 2, Incredible Hulk, Thor, and Captain America, the First Avenger. It combines all the main stars of those films together, with, of course, a replacement of Edward Norton from The Incredible Hulk with Mark Ruffalo. Sorry, Mark.
And what a fantastic choice that was.
It was an excellent choice.
Mark Ruffalo does a really top-notch job.
So the heavy hitters of the Marvel Universe films.
Literally.
Yep, literally. Put together to save the Earth from an alien invasion.
Tell us, Crystal, did you enjoy the film?
I did. Stop laughing. I did enjoy the film. I enjoyed the comedy a lot. If they didn't have the comedy in there, I don't think I would have paid attention nearly as much as I did. The only problem I had with the film, which I have with most action films, is that some of the action scenes went on a little too long. Luke says
Luke says, I like that.
Luke says that the role of action in a film is to progress a story. And sometimes the story wasn't actually progressing. It was just a case of, let's see how we can beat each other up really cool in really cool ways.
Yeah, but that's very comic-y. I mean, that is
very comic-y, but that's where you kind of lose my interest a bit. But the comedy was...
I think probably a little bit early on, the Iron Man-Thor confrontation at the start of the film was probably a little bit lengthy. But overall, I think they actually
And that did smack of... let's have a superhero knockdown.
That's the exact scene I had in mind.
Which is, that's a very comic book thing to do, but I do see Crystal's point. It actually doesn't progress the story.
Well,
the moment afterwards where Cap comes in.
Yeah.
And you actually get a nice shot between, you know, what is the Trinity of the Avengers, Cap.
But if he had come in about, well, it felt really long, so I'll say 5 minutes earlier, but probably it wasn't actually that long.
Probably about 30 seconds to a minute earlier.
So, like I said, it's the heavy hitters of the Marvel Universe, so you've got a lot of egos there. You've got some big names in their characters as well as the actors themselves. Richard, you were saying in our previous episode that you were worried that Chris Evans as Captain America would be sort of overshadowed and not really be at the forefront that he was. How do you think that went?
I'm actually very pleasantly surprised for the most part by how that went down. I really thought that Robert Downey Jr. And even Samuel L. Jackson might overshadow Chris Evans, partially because of Chris Evans' performance in Captain America, The First Avenger. I thought he just wasn't quite Captain America-y enough for me. He didn't quite have that take charge personality, that high level of charisma that Captain America in the comics has. I mean, in the comics, Cap is able to rally basically the entire Marvel universe.
Yeah, but that was kind of building up to that.
They did. And there are two things I think that they did very well in this film in order to make that work. The first was that they played up the idea of Captain America as a man out of time. Mm. You know, he's just woken up having been on ice since World War II. So a little bit of that played to that nicely, because Cap's not quite at that level of confidence that you see in the comic books, say, these days.
And whilst that is, they probably could have done a little bit more. I know they're not going to give the whole Cap out of time story.
Well, I think
they're going to say
that
Captain America 2, and that's where it should be safe for, but just a little bit more to show the distance that he, or the perceived distance that he might have between him and the rest of the team, S.H.I.E.L.D., the world, and that gives you... There's a little bit of it there. I would have liked a little bit more.
I think
there's enough. I think if you tried to overplay it too much... Because there is a... One of the strengths of this film, too, I find, is that there is actually some very good character work done.
And it's not about any one character.
Exactly, yeah. And all of the characters have time to establish who they are, what they're about, why they're there.
I quite enjoyed the build-up and that they're getting the team together a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, it was nice to see, because they could have just gone straight into the action and just made it an action fest. You know, they could have made it like a Michael Bay Transformers type film where there just are no characters.
But with Joss Whedon at the helm, you know, that's not going to be the case. Yeah, I mean, he's all about the characters. I mean, he made Firefly what it was, but you know, with multiple characters,
exactly right,
who all had their own distinct personalities and their own moments. So, what was the second thing that you said was good?
Yeah, the other good thing I think they did in building Captain America up was that they did establish that when in a war zone, Cap is in his element. So when it comes time for them to rally as a team to fight off the alien invasion, that's when Cap gets several really great moments to shine and to show what a leader he is and to show the strategist that he is. I mean, when there's a scene when they're all standing on the bridge whilst this invasion is taking place, and they all turn to Captain America because that's what he does. He fights wars. He
I really
like
that. Yeah.
And
well,
so
he didn't stand up and say, hey, listen to me, we're going to do this.
No,
there was a small lull and then everybody just turned around.
Yeah, there was no big sort of speech, which can come across a little bit corny these days if it's badly written. So
I prefer the scene where he was directing a policeman.
That was also another excellent moment, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they did that well. It said, yes, he's a man out of time. Yes, he's a little bit unsure of himself in his personal life and in his interactions with others. But you put him on a battlefield and he gets a chance to shine. And so I give full credit to Joss Whedon and to Chris Evans, who I thought really stepped up his game.
Well, he actually started filming directly after Captain America First Avenger, but he had like 2 days off and then bang, he was back into it.
Yeah, and you can see that he's a lot more comfortable in the role.
Probably because he's a better director.
Well, look, I think that's probably a big part of it. And somebody more willing to direct him as a character, as opposed to just trying to direct the film, to actually give him direction on where to go with the character.
Plus also a better sense of the script. I think overall, and we're talking a bit about Captain America, and we've also got the other cast members to talk about as well. I got more sense of Captain America, you know, in the Avengers than I did in Captain America.
Very much so.
And says something about the quality of Captain America.
Well, there's credit to Joss Whedon and his co-writer on this because...
Zach Penn? Yeah.
The character work in this, I thought, was excellent.
Yeah.
And it gave everybody a chance to shine. And all the actors really, I think, just stepped up for it.
Yeah, like you said, we focused a lot on Captain America. Just saying, well, we'll focus on the other characters as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to talk a bit about Joss.
Just before we move on, you asked about the egos before. I thought they used that to good effect when they were all... arguing, and it almost became their downfall.
Yeah, very much.
And it's a very Marvel Comics thing too, for the heroes to sort of argue and bicker a little bit at first, and want to go off on their own. And I mean, it happens actually in Avengers number one. When they're fighting the Hulk, you know. So they've done a great job of actually both adapting and updating the original Avengers number one story into sort of the modern film universe that they've created. I thought they did that fantastically.
So before the film came out, just about everybody who interviewed Joss Whedon was, you know, was talking about how you're going to make it not be Iron Man centric.
Yeah.
You know, how are you going to pull that off? And I think he does. I mean, we don't want to give too much away. Like you said, everybody has their arc, which I think is very, very cool.
The Hulk arc was lacking a little bit. I do think he sort of... got to the point where it was more sure of himself a bit quickly.
But this time being passed from the Incredible Hulk film.
No, I meant during this film. Like at the start, Thor's trying to explain to him, Iron Man's trying to explain to him, like, you just make it a part of yourself and you don't be afraid of it. And then you don't see him for a little while, and then he reveals his secret, how he controls his anger all the time. There could have been a little bit more in there on the Hulk.
Okay.
I don't agree.
I see what Crystal's saying.
I see what you're saying. I think it's covered. I mean, I think it's covered enough in the Incredible Hulk film. Like at the end of the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah, but if you want this to be a film that can also stand on its own, which it can, you don't have to have seen all the other films, then I think that's a little bit like...
I agree. The Hulk storyline is the least developed.
Yeah.
Fortunately, they've gotten a very good actor who can actually pull it off. He's a really nicely nuanced performance as well. There's a nervousness about him. There's a desire to control what's inside him. And I think that comes across even with only a limited amount of information provided about the character. Just his body language, the way he speaks.
The crouched, hunched thing.
Yeah, I think
he's just... Sense of humour.
Yeah, that kind of self-depreciating sense of humour.
But then they make it up to him by giving you all the best scenes. I mean, the Hulk gets... some pretty magnificent scenes.
Yeah.
The Hulk has... there's a couple of absolute brilliant action sequences involving the Hulk going nuts.
He actually gets quite a nice scene, I think, with Tony Stark when they're on the S.H.I.E.L.D. helicarrier. Getting back to the scene that Crystal was talking about, where Tony Stark's trying to effectively be a mentor to him.
Yeah.
But instead of it feeling like the Tony Stark... you know, dominating thing. There's a nice sense of balance.
Yeah.
There's respect on Tony Stark's part for Banner's intelligence.
Yeah.
So he's not trying to, you know, just lord over him. He's actually trying to work. They are trying to make it so that the two characters are working together.
Yeah.
And trying to form a bond. And I thought that was really effective. I think that's one of the successful things about the film, is they actually do get the relationships right.
Yeah,
exactly right.
I think that overall there's a good balance between action, humour, big epic storytelling, and just really strong character moments to sort of balance everything out.
Yeah, that's what I think is the main winner of this film, and why I enjoyed it so much it just seemed to have the perfect balance of everything that you wanted in a comic book movie.
Yeah.
It had the comedic scenes, which is the classic Joss Whedon scenes. Everybody had their arc. I mean, Black Widow had quite an extensive role for it. I mean, unlike Iron Man 2, where she was basically just there as eye candy, whereas this time she actually gets to do some stuff.
Yeah.
Especially her opening scene, which I thought was hilarious.
Oh, one of the highlights of the film.
Yeah, and Hawkeye as well. Everybody had their part to play, and it was so well done in its mix. I was actually surprised.
It was a good balance. It didn't take itself too seriously, but it wasn't a spoof either. Whereas I think that was the downfall of Captain America. It took itself as a serious film, and it's a comic book film. It's not meant to be serious.
Yeah, totally right.
There's one thing that I'd like to comment on here is actually the use of Loki in this film.
Yeah.
First of all, Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah.
Tom Hiddleston, I think, is a lot more comfortable now in the role. But they just give him a much stronger motivation. I mean, I really enjoyed Thor the film, but I thought probably the weakest aspect of it was that Loki's motivations for what he was doing were a bit weak and understated.
Spoiled British.
Yeah, very much so. Whereas here...
I think in the previous review you said he was like a whingy emo kid or something.
Yeah, whereas here... There's
he was allowed to be Loki. He's allowed
exactly,
to be the villain.
He's evil, he's mischievous, he's a master manipulator.
There was still a bit of the what did I say?
Wingy.
The wingy.
There was, yeah. But, I mean, having established that personality already, it actually wasn't quite so bad here because to see him being the trickster god that he's meant to be.
That's right, yeah.
You know, the way he just manipulates everybody early on in the film is just fantastic.
Including Thor. I like the way Thor constantly still thinks he can, you know, win him over.
Yeah.
Remember what it was like in the good old days. And he just doesn't understand that this guy is crazy yet.
and I'm glad to see that. I'm glad that they really made Loki into the villain that he's meant to be. I mean, he is one of the great comic book villains.
Yeah,
and here they really gave him a chance to shine. It was great.
Yeah, I mean, he had his comedic moments, which were cool.
Yeah.
But then the scene with Black Widow, where he shows just how bad he actually is, and he really is evil. But then he has some more comedic moments after that.
And
really cool.
And once again, there's some nice nuanced moments as well. You know, there's a moment in the film where he's actually inflicting pain upon somebody for an actual plot point. He needs something from this person. He's inflicting pain, and then you just see this very sort of slight smirk that he gets on his face, like, hey, I'm really enjoying this.
Yeah, you know, just he's more enjoying the reaction of everybody running away in fear.
Yeah,
like, exactly. When I saw that, all I could think was, he looks like Sheldon Cooper.
With that creepy smile.
If Sheldon was a god. So let's talk about the... So that's the characters, which I think they pulled off perfectly fine.
Plus Jeremy Renner as Hawkeye, well. I think, does pretty good. Because he's only in a blink and you'll miss it moment in Thor.
Whereas, a totally pointless moment.
I like the Agent
Coulson. Let's just introduce the character so that, you know, people know who he is going into Avengers. Whereas I think, and I hated him in the Hurt Locker, and I hated the Hurt Locker anyway, but I think he does a very good job.
And of course, we didn't mention Thor as well, but yes, Thor is...
Chris Hemsworth, I think, is of the main guys, the one who suffers the least, who suffers the most. He doesn't have as much to do. He gets a nice fight with the Hulk on the helicarrier.
Oh, he's also got the, you know, please don't do this Loki stuff. Because
it's not developed, and that's my main problem, I think the story needed a little bit more work. He sort of falls by the wayside, whereas...
I actually don't think he needed as much work. I think that he was so well established in Thor as a character.
I agree.
To give him something to do throughout the story. There was a moment
where you were like, where's Thor gone?
Yeah, where's Thor gone? And then where he's sort of doubting himself, where he's reaching out to Mjolnir and doesn't feel he's worthy enough to pick up the hammer.
Yeah, but that's...
I didn't quite get why he was suddenly feeling not worthy, given that... The reason why things have happened is not because he hasn't actually sort of set up the plate. He has, and he's... Yeah.
And that moment seemed to last an extraordinarily long time because they come back to it later and go, hang on, he's still there?
I must admit, there was
a couple of moments like that. Also, there's a scene where Cap is hanging off a wire on the shield carrier, and I'm just thinking... Gee, Cap's been hanging there for a long time. By now, he would have tried to basically claw his way back.
And then, of course, when he needs to claw his way up, he's up there.
He's
like
up
2 seconds.
So there are a couple of little moments like that.
But I thought with the Thor thing that it was, well, we're trying that's the Earth people defending Earth, so, and he's sort of a visitor, so I didn't feel his absence all that much.
And he steps up for the big moments, which is very much a Thor thing in the comics. In the Avengers comics, Thor is often not present until you require somebody to step up and confront the big bad guy. And he has a lot of great moments in the comics where he's missing for two-thirds of a story. Suddenly Thor steps up and you're like, yeah, this story has now become massive. You know, this has now become epic because Thor is there.
Yeah, but they do that because if Thor was there from the start, there wouldn't be any story because he'd just take them all out. And that would be
more as a character is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. I agree with what you're saying. There's a scene where he's talking to Fury and he's sort of gazed out the window and stuff. And it's like, well, it's kind of weak. I don't really see the... It could have been done a bit better. But overall,
but having said that, with so much going on, and also with the need to introduce a couple of the other characters properly, like the Black Widow, Hawkeye, to a lesser extent, the Hulk.
Yeah.
But with the need to sort of introduce that a bit and to deal with Cap as a man out of time, I think sort of Thor going a little bit by the wayside wasn't too bad for me because he was such a well-developed and I think probably the best of the developed characters in his previous film.
Iron Man for sure.
Iron Man.
I mean, he basically shows up in the film and you don't need to know anything because you know exactly who he is and what he does.
Yeah, but he is a great character established right from the outset and continues to just be a great character because of a pretty well-written script, but mainly because Robert Downey Jr. is unbelievably charismatic.
I'm glad Justin didn't let him dominate the scenes. He's a clear presence whenever he appears, and he's brilliant.
Yeah,
but he's never allowed to dominate, which I thought was like the scene, which I thought was
pretty. Yeah, they do kind of downplay him a little bit. I think in that regard, like he's not quite as over the top in this as he is in the Iron Man films, which I think was a good choice.
Do you know what I like about Iron Man as compared to the other superheroes? Is it just he wanders around in his day clothes and he only puts on his suit when he actually has to go and do stuff. And the suit's sort of like a functional working thing that he's created, but his day clothes are just normal everyday grungy day clothes.
His Black Sabbath t-shirt.
Yeah, it's a bit more realistic.
let's talk a bit production. So it's quite extravagant. There's a ridiculous amount of special effects shots.
But the special effects don't overwhelm the story.
That's right. I think the special effects serve the story. Yeah. There was a couple of things that I wasn't too pleased with. I just think that the space serpent things looked way too much like Shockwave from Transformers 3. And even made the same noise.
And the creatures from Skyline and Battle Los Angeles. A little bit more of a Kirby-esque feel to them might have been a bit more appreciated to give them something a bit more dynamic.
Yeah, I don't know. Not a huge amount,
but just something to make them look a little bit more like they belong in the Marvel Universe, as to say, you know, just straight out of another, you know, big blockbuster science fiction action.
I did appreciate that it wasn't a giant robot. Mm.
It was organic.
It was. But other than that, I think the special effects were very well done.
Yep.
I mean,
just want to take a second here to just comment on how good the Hulk looked.
Oh, yeah. That unbelievable.
Was just one of the best, you know, pure CGI creations I've seen. Yep. Probably the best I've seen since possibly King Kong.
He wasn't as ripped as the Incredible Hulk version, but he wasn't as flabby as the Ang Lee Hulk.
Yeah.
And he also wasn't, like, ridiculously tall. He was taller than Thor, but not so much taller.
You could see a resemblance in the face, too. You could still see the character.
Yeah. And he was a very big, muscular character, but it wasn't like they put extra muscles on top of him to make him even more muscular.
The Incredible Hulk version has got zero fat. And so it's just bands of muscle, and it's just distracting. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still better than the Ang Lee version, but it's just so distracting that you can't really watch it. Whereas this version, he just looked like a real presence. You know what I mean? Especially that scene where Thor and Hulk are standing next to each other, and it's like, this looks magnificent.
There is one thing I want to comment on negatively about the production design, and that's I got to say, Captain America's uniform.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. Not great.
I still don't know why they haven't gone for more of the chainmail look.
Yeah,
it's kind of just...
Or at least more armor, like a Kevlar version.
Go the armor.
I understand what they're doing with this.
I mean, they did a better job.
To give a bit more flexibility, but at least whilst the design of the new Batman costume isn't that great, they've at least gone, he needs body armor to protect himself. And I think Cap needs...
I actually preferred the first Avenger version of the Cap outfit.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's obviously a little bit more of a soldier uniform. Yeah. You know, they actually give him...
I think they realise the suit's not too good because he's taken the mask off, like...
A couple of comes off accidentally.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
It comes off, it gets
80% of the time he's in the costume, but without the helmet, without the mask.
I thought, what's the point of him wearing it? Because you can see it clearly.
What I don't understand as well is, I mean, they've done a really great job on Thor's
costume
armor. Mm. I think Thor looked great in this, and he never wears the helmet.
No,
but
which is fine,
you know. But that for a movie, you know, that makes sense. But yeah, they've done such a great job on Thor's look that yeah, Captain America just kind of looks a bit weak by comparison to everybody else in the film.
Loki wears the helmet, and it makes him seem pretentious. And so maybe the fact that he doesn't wear the helmet is deliberate. Yeah.
Oh, I think you're right.
Yeah, I love
Loki wears it like a crown.
Yeah.
I loved both of Loki's looks in this. Mm-hmm. The armoured look that he has, and then when he's just sort of wandering around in his robes. So it's like they've done really great production design across the board, except on Captain America.
And the serpent creatures.
I didn't like the at the very beginning of the film, the up shots, looking up at Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, some of the camera work was a bit
very
bit
glad that didn't continue throughout the film.
Yeah,
I think that's Joss Whedon trying to go, I am not a TV director, I'm a film director now. And that's what he was going for.
Also,
shots that looked a bit more creative than he's used to. I'm using the term as, you know, nicely as possible there.
I think also, though, when you're shooting up, you know, from that sort of low angle up at characters, it is designed specifically to make people look bigger, in this case, more heroic.
Yeah. I know that. I don't think you know that, and I'm doing this to make you get that.
There's about 2 minutes of just those shots, basically.
And there's another shot during the Black Widow interrogation where she, like, flips some dude over with their legs and stuff, and the camera actually goes on its side. I was like, what was the point of that? It doesn't make anything seem easier to see.
I didn't.
It's an artistic choice.
Having said that, I think Joss Whedon has actually, with this, has actually stepped up his game into being a film director.
Totally.
His previous efforts have very much looked like, you know, TV directing on the big screen. And it is a very different style of filmmaking. In this, I think he's actually really stepped it up. And it does, you know, it comes across for the most part as very well directed.
I think he's still got a way to go. I think he got better towards the end, particularly with the final SmackDown.
Yeah.
At the start and in the middle, there's a bit of flab. Not just in terms of the script, in terms of the filmmaking as well. The shots could have been a bit tighter.
Yeah.
The cuts could have been a bit cleaner and could have been a bit snappier. Just to help keep things going along, I thought there were moments where we were holding on shots for just a bit too long.
So you wouldn't be buying the extended version when it comes out?
Possibly not.
Look, honestly, I'm just glad there was no lens flare. The worst thing I see from lens flare, and it wasn't JJ Abrams. That's the thing. It's the worst thing you see from TV directors stepping up into film is this constant reliance on lens flare.
Even worse than lens flare is, I don't know if you've seen Serenity, but there's a scene where Mal's giving his big speech about why they're going to do what they're going to do.
Oh, and then you've got the light
behind
yeah.
And it actually puts him into shadow.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is the worst light shot I've ever seen.
Yeah. Once again, that's TV directing.
It makes the lens flare of Star Trek look good.
Yeah.
It's really
bad. I
hate that lens flare.
Well, I think he's moved up to another level with this.
He's definitely improved. There's no doubt about it. I mean, if his choice of camera work was as good as his storytelling, I think he'd be a master. But it's definitely an improvement. You're right.
Yeah.
But overall, awesome stuff. So let's just get a couple more. Anybody got any more negatives out of the way before we
Yeah, it actually took a while for me to really get into the film.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of enjoying the small moments that I was seeing. But it wasn't up until the moment where where the group is actually together and they're arguing.
Yeah.
From that point onwards, I really started to enjoy the film.
Okay.
Up until that point, I kind of felt it was bitsy, and I wasn't really into the story. I just felt there's a moment between where Thor, Cap, and Iron Man, they've had their fight. Cap's actually done a pretty good job of bringing them together, and you get a nice moment between, you know, the Trinity of the Avengers. And then to the moment where they are arguing, and without giving things away, there is another big action scene on the S.H.I.E.L.D. helicarrier.
Yeah.
in between, I just sort of, I was almost a bit bored.
Okay.
Yeah, I think
I like the lead up. I like the gathering of the people.
There you go. My big thing was that there was no real development. There was a plot. There was an idea for the plot to get them going, getting the Tesseract.
Well, it's kind of also a bit of a recap for if you hadn't seen the other films before, or those who hadn't seen them for a while.
Yeah. I do agree. There was a slight lull in the film for me just before that big confrontation on the shield carrier that you mentioned. It was just a little bit too long.
Yeah,
but for once it got going again, it was I thought it really just
everything from the conversation in the lab, like the big argument onwards, is just a juggernaut. It's just a train of a film. It just doesn't stop from there.
But still, never losing the good character moments.
That's exactly right.
And that's sort of what sustained me through that lull. But I was in there going, I want the story to develop. The strongest storyline I thought with the characters was, in fact, Black Widow's story. Or the potential for it to be pretty strong.
Oh, a superpowered female, that's Joss Whedon's staple.
It's a staple. It gets revealed that, you know, she's done some stuff that she's not proud of in her career. And there might be a redemptive story arc. And also, and this is without giving things away because it's quite early on, she wants to help Hawkeye.
Yeah.
That's her thing. I actually wondered if it would be a good idea to give her the lion's share of the film and actually see the formation of the team more from her eyes.
But if you do it that way, you lose too much of the character stories.
I'm not saying where it becomes solely her story.
But if you're seeing it through her as your POV character, then you're missing out on a lot of what's going on.
Well, the Black Widow would be my other negative, because her story is the only one where I felt that I missed a bit.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly nothing in Iron Man 2 that you've missed out on. So what was presented in the Avengers really was just everything that they wanted to tell you about the character.
That's all you need to know, really.
Yeah, so, you know, Russian spy.
A bit more about Clint would have been good.
I liked
why the archery, of all things. I mean, he's a special forces officer.
That's not really explained either, is it?
Cool. Also, maybe a little bit more about Loki's allies. And I'm saying that without giving things away, because...
Yeah, it's all over the interwebs, but we're not going to give it away for our listeners.
There's a thing that keys you in it. There's more to what's going on, but we sat next to a person who's not a comic book fan, and they turned to us and asked us, "Well, hang on, what's that about? Who's that?"
Yeah, so you're talking about the bits. So after the film ends, we have a brief credits sequence where they do the main people, and then they, instead of having the end credits tidbit, they actually had it up in that bit there. Mm. Which is then reveals the ultimate bad guy. So the bad guy behind Loki.
And sets up Iron Man 2. Sets up Avengers 2, sorry.
Yeah, that's right. And so he turned to you and initially said, who was that?
Yeah.
Because when that scene appeared, I was like, that's awesome.
Yeah, there were people in the crowd clapping and cheering.
Yeah, everybody was going, oh, awesome. And I went, who the?
Without spoiling, because I also went, that is cool, because that's...
It is a magnificent
scene. It's one of my favourite aspects of the Marvel Universe. But up until that point, the army that Loki has is just...
It's a generic army.
Just a generic army. So just a little bit more... maybe a bit more investigation on the Avengers part as to... Because Thor knows who they are, because he says. He tells the Avengers who they are. So just a little bit more of an investigation, just so they get more of an idea who they're dealing with.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. They just sort of go in with no knowledge whatsoever.
I suppose that didn't really bother me all that much, because the focus, as far as villains go, the focus was on Loki as the leader of an army.
Yeah.
And so I really wasn't all that concerned about Loki's army. I was more concerned about what Loki was doing. And I mean, I do take your point. But
I wanted a tighter story, as usual. I want a tighter story.
See, I thought the story was actually
as tight as it needed to be.
Nah. Yeah, it was.
Still, it could have been tighter. Yes, it could have. But it didn't need to be tighter. And that's why I think it was fine.
The way that the characters react to what's going on then dictates where the story goes from that point.
Exactly.
And so, therefore, the characters are still driving the story. Yes, they are reacting to a big war situation that's going on. But it's because of the strong characters dictating the direction that the story goes.
And but they're not dictating the direction of the action.
I agree with you. That happens after the big argument. Up until then, it's just, we just need to get all the things into place.
Oh, there's no argument there.
Well, no, but it's also, we have to introduce who these characters are, we have to move them into place, And you have to show them coming together as a team. And that's part of what this is, because you're dealing with very strong, ego-driven individuals that need to come together as a team. And I think they built that up beautifully.
I think they could have done a far better job, because it just felt like, let's just put all the elements in place so that we can satisfy all the action requirements for this type of story.
No, you're just wrong.
Okay, all right. I'm going to put a mediate hat, and we'll stop it there. That was very entertaining, but we'll be here for hours otherwise. Let's go into any final thoughts and ratings. Richard?
I thought that this was actually the best of Marvel's movies.
The Marvel Studios?
Of the Marvel Studios movies that we've gotten over the last sort of 10 or so years.
That, of course, means we can't count the Spider-Man films, which means we can't count Spider-Man 2.
Yes. But I think that this is
really
the one that has...
That's okay, let's not count Spider-Man 2. This is still better.
You think Avengers is better than Spider-Man 2?
I was certainly more entertained by it.
All right, let's move on.
Let's talk about
that. Before I start
beating
you up.
As I said, I think this has found an almost perfect balance between character-driven moments, action moments, humor moments. I think it's all come together perfectly, and that Marvel's plan has actually come to fruition in this film. And I respect the work that they've done to get up to this point.
You can only imagine the looks on their faces at the moment. I mean, they'd be jumping for joy.
Yeah.
I don't remember being in a cinema. Recently anyway, I don't remember being in a cinema where the audience have clapped at the end.
Yeah, that was
pretty
impressive.
I haven't seen an audience clapping and cheering this much since Yoda in Attack of the Clones.
Good call. We also need to point out, before Richard, we continue, we actually saw the non-3D version, so we can't really comment on the 3D effects and whether they're any good or anything. But judging from the 2D version, I didn't see anything that was obvious. Like, Thor didn't throw the hammer directly at the screen.
That was put in there to make it for the 3D.
Yeah, it probably was, but who knows.
Yeah, so, in summing up, I think they've done an excellent job here. It's not a flawless film, but I thought it was very good, and I'm giving it 4 Lukes.
Luke?
I agree with Richo in that it is the best of the Marvel films to date. I disagree with just about everything else he said. Let me qualify. I was entertained, and I did laugh at the humorous moments. I did appreciate the small character moments. Would have liked a much, much tighter story for the first half of the film. Mm-hmm. I thought you could have done so much more. Having said that, the last action scene is, I'm going to say this now, the best superhero fight scene ever done.
Outdone Superman 2.
Even better than Superman 2.
Fair enough.
I give this 2.5 Lukes.
You are the harshest critic I've ever known.
You've just given it less than a Ron Howard film.
So that's... Avengers, 2.5 Lukes.
Yes.
You stand by that statement.
I stand by that statement.
Crystal.
I give this 4 Lukes. And it's probably the best out of the recent crop of superhero films I've seen. It's still not better than Superman movie.
I just want to support Crystal by saying that she and I have ranked this film the same, thus proving that Luke is wrong.
What about me?
Just because I liked it better than Luke doesn't mean he's wrong.
He's definitely wrong.
I agree with points that both of you have said.
And what did you think, Dave?
I'm going to go right on the fence with both of you as well. I actually do agree with points that both of you have said, but I'm leaning more towards Crystal and Richo. I don't think this is as good as Superman the movie or Spider-Man 2, which I give 5 Lukes.
It's better than Spider-Man 2.
Seriously, people. I'm going to go on a murderous rampage in a second.
I just want to say that I support David here. Spider-Man 2, awesome.
It is awesome.
Yes, and they're wrong.
But I thoroughly enjoy this film. I cannot tell you just how... I mean, our followers will know that I was mad, crazy excited for it before we went into it, with the tweets and the posts. And I actually did one of my spotlights on the films that led up to this, the Road to the Avengers. I have to agree with the crew in saying that it is definitely the best of the Marvel Studios films. And I just think it's a perfect example of how a superhero movie should be done. And I give it 4.5 Lukes. It was almost perfect. I do agree with Luke's everything before the argument in the lab, which I think is a magnificent scene. Everything before that, Yeah, it had some cool moments. The Black Widow scene is one of the best introductions of a character, I think, that I've seen in the Marvel films, at least. It's awesome stuff. But yeah, it could have been trimmed a bit more, I think. But everything from then on was just absolutely wonderful, amazing stuff. I was on the edge of my seat, and just the humour, I thought, was just spot on. I mean, there was not a single joke where I thought that was lame. It was just all spot on stuff. And look, I had to agree with you again, the fight sequence, especially when Hulk, you know, Hulk smash and off he goes. It's just magnificent.
There was a build up for a number of years to this film, and people would sit there and wait till the end of the credits to see what the next little sneaky bit was going to be. So given this build up, do you guys think that this film has met expectations? Is this the wow, amazing film that Marvel kind of promised with the build up?
Definitely.
I would say it's actually, in many respects, exceeded my expectation, because I'll be honest with you, my expectation of this film actually wasn't that high.
Yeah.
I actually thought, after all that build-up, they're going to botch it.
We should just point out here that Avenger, of the four people sitting here, Richo was probably the biggest Avengers fan.
That's true. I am an Avengers fanatic, I admit that. And that probably played into it as well. I thought, they've built this up, you know, and they're going to blow it. They're going to do something wrong, and I'm going to walk away from the film really annoyed. Kind of a bit like I was with Captain America. But yeah, so they've actually exceeded my expectations with this film quite substantially.
That was a good question.
I thought so.
Excellent question, yeah.
How about yourself? I mean, you were forced to sit through the preceding films.
It is better. It's much better than I thought it was going to be.
I heard you chuckling a couple of times.
I chuckled a lot because I enjoy the comedy, and I think there should be more comedy in superhero films.
There is I just want to point out, without spoiling anything, there is an absolutely hilarious moment that got us all laughing between Hulk and Thor.
I don't think there was anybody in the audience that was not laughing at that scene.
Yeah, that was
everything
just,
from
that
the
was
little
just,
kids who were just, it was just like, oh, cool, to the adults who were just like, that's bad.
It was
a real Saturday morning cartoon.
I'm undecided whether I think, because I'm not a big fan of the superhero films to start with, so the build up didn't really mean all that much to me. I'm undecided whether it meets expectations.
Just do it. You get four and five. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that's it. That's our Avengers review. Our opinions. I can't just go see this film. Go see it on the big screen. It's definitely a big screen experience.
No doubt about it.
Unless you're lucky enough to have one of those ridiculously large TVs.
At Nerd Culture Podcast do not condone downloading.
No, we do not.
This is a good example of how to do a big blockbuster popcorn film. Right.
And it's right up there with the best superhero films.
Yeah. And take a cushion.
In our opinion, not Luke's opinion, but
take a cushion because it's a long film.
It does go for a while. It's like two and a half hours, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, I'd just like to point out that, you know, it did quite exceed my expectations because they were pretty low to begin with.
Well, there you go.
Awesome. Okay, coming up next, let's continue the Avengers theme with a roundtable on all things Avengers in the comics.
Oh, yeah.
I know you're especially fired over, Jay.
Avengers Assemble, baby.
Just no Jocasta.
What's wrong with Jocasta?
I might go to sleep.
Roundtable. We're knights of the round table, we dance where we're able. We do routines, we call the scenes, we footwork impeccable. We dine well here in Camelot, we eat ham and jam and spam a lot. Okay, let's hit it with our roundtable on The Avengers. The Avengers debuted in The Avengers number 1, funnily enough, September 1963, using existing characters created primarily by writer-editor Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, who also co-plotted and penciled. The great Jack Kirby. The Avengers movie should have been Jack Kirby's The Avengers. And Stan Lee, of course. Sorry.
There's actually been a bit of a dispute about that, from a bit of an uproar from fans, in that Kevin Feige, when he's been talking about the Avengers film, has been playing up Stan Lee's involvement as the creator of the Avengers.
Yeah.
But not Jack Kirby in any way. But fortunately, Jack is actually credited in the film, which is...
Yeah, that's true. I mean, let's not take anything away from Stan Lee, but...
No.
Still, I mean, give Kirby the credit that he is due. I mean, you call him the king. Why not treat him like the king?
Exactly right.
It's ridiculous. Yeah, so the Avengers were started in order to compete with DC Comics' Justice League of America, which was very successful at the time. So the idea of getting your your heavy hitters together into one team. The initial series was published bi-monthly through to issue six, and then monthly. Labelled Earth's Mightiest Heroes, the Avengers originally consisted of Iron Man, Ant-Man, Wasp, Thor, and Hulk, and Captain America then joined in issue four.
Absolutely classic moment in the book, and really the first moment that elevates the book.
Into and something better than Hulk's that. Left by that point, yeah.
Yeah, Hulk leaves. Hulk leaves at the end of issue two.
Yeah, that's right.
And then in issue three, he teams up with the Submariner to actually fight the Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
And but when Captain America comes in issue four, the book just steps it up a level.
Yeah. So throughout the years, the Avengers, whose battle cry is "Avengers Assemble," has featured humans, mutants, robots, gods, aliens, supernatural beings, and even former villains.
The second major turning point for the Avengers is actually Avengers 16, where all of those heavy hitters that they had, except Captain America, leave the team, and he gets Quicksilver, the Scarlet Witch, and Hawkeye, all former villains, suddenly sign up for the team. And yeah, it's actually a pretty amazing moment to, you know, to take your winning formula and dump it. And to bring in, you know, three possibly reforming villains to make up your team.
Then, of course, Dark Scarlet Witch becoming a staple, staples of the series.
Absolutely. And it's
not so much, but...
It's a credit to Stan Lee, but more importantly, I think, to Roy Thomas, who took over from Stan Lee around about issue 25 or thereabouts, that they were able to take these villain characters and actually make them into mainstays of the Avengers team.
It must have been
a pretty radical moment for readers at the time, back in the 60s, to suddenly have the team just dumped and replaced.
So like all comics, it had its own spin-off series. One of them was West Coast Avengers, when some of the team went off to the West Coast of America, funnily enough, which had some classic stories.
Yep, absolutely.
Is that like NCIS LA?
Yeah, same deal.
Sort of. It stemmed from a story in which...
NCIS Avengers.
It stemmed from a story in the main book in which a character called The Vision effectively took over the world. And he decided that the Avengers would be more effective in, you know, protecting America and the world if they actually had a team on both coasts. So he set up a second team.
There was also another series called Solo Avengers, which was retitled Avengers Spotlight at issue 21, which I was a big fan of. There's a really cool Hawkeye story.
Yeah.
So a brief history of the Avengers in comics. Now, the first adventure featured the Asgardian god Loki, just like the film. Who wanted revenge against Thor. The roster changes almost immediately, as Richo said. For the second issue, Ant-Man becomes Giant Man, and Hulk leaves. They fight Namor. Captain America joins, and then they go on to fight quite a lot of Captain America villains. Baron Zemo, the Masters of Evil.
Great stuff. I love the Masters of Evil.
Kang the Conqueror, Wonder Man, back when he was a villain, and Count Nefaria. But they were eventually rejoined by Henry Pym, Goliath, and the Wasp.
That's true. He's become Goliath by this point.
Yeah, and then also Hercules, Black Knight, and Black Widow. They also eventually get Black Panther and the Vision, who was named because his first appearance scares the Wasp.
He's an unearthly vision in her mind.
Plus, he also looks like the Golden Age character.
Yeah.
The Vision.
He does, yeah.
Which is, you know, not apparent when you read the story, but when you look at the cover.
But that first appearance of his, those first two issues, just brilliant. One of the best Avengers stories. And also featuring one of the most iconic Avengers covers. Behold the Vision.
Behold the Vision.
57, just fantastic.
It's like classic old sci-fi with the aliens and stuff like
that. It is, it's brilliant stuff.
The day the Earth stood still and stuff like that. The Avengers are headquartered in Avengers Mansion, which is until it's destroyed a couple of times, it's just a staple, their home base. It's provided by Tony Stark, who's Iron Man's real identity, obviously, and he's mega, mega rich. And the mansion is serviced by Edwin Jarvis, who I'd just like to point out that on the back cover of the Avengers Under Siege story, trade paperback, which I'll get to later, which is the best Avengers story, it has three rules. There are certain unwritten rules that apply to the Avengers. The Earth's Mightiest Heroes are a unified and unbeatable unit. No intelligent foe would launch a direct assault on their mansion. And third, Jarvis, the team's butler, is off limits to physical assault. Touch Jarvis at your folly. He's a legend.
It's amazing just how Jarvis develops as a character and does become one of the absolute essential elements of the team. It's so much so that eventually they actually just start doing issues focused entirely on him and his life. There's probably a good 3 or 4 issues devoted purely to him. And that's pretty amazing for a guy who is basically just a butler.
Basically Alfred in the Marvel Universe. The next adventure for the Avengers was versus the Squadron Supreme, who are essentially the Justice League. Which is pretty cool. And a firm favourite of mine. I love the Squadron Supreme. Awesome.
Well, actually, it was actually the Squadron Sinister at that point.
That's true.
It's not until a little bit later that you find out that the Squadron Sinister were actually created as cosmic clones of a group called the Squadron Supreme who live on their own Earth and they are essentially the Justice League.
I love the moment in the JLA event, the Justice League Avengers crossover that they did in the early noughties, where Hawkeye in the DC Universe is sort of a bit perplexed by this strange familiar sensation he keeps getting from the Justice League.
Yeah, he realizes
that they're nothing but Squadron Supreme wannabes.
And that's the line he uses. Who are these Squadron Supreme wannabes? Which I think is just awesome.
It is cool. And then, of course, they move on to the epic Kree-Skrull War, which guest starred Kree hero Captain Marvel.
Yay!
Well, that was a big turning point for the book as well. I mean, it went from, these sort of, big storylines to creating this multi-part epic that in many respects changed the nature of Marvel Comics in general. Suddenly, big epic storylines were the way to go.
Then the Vision and the Scarlet Witch fall in love, which is a bit strange. A mutant and an android.
Don't get me started. One of the best couples in Marvel's history.
Really?
Absolutely. Well, think about it.
Reed and Sue?
Also a great couple. Peter and Mary Jane, also a great couple. But you've got, as you pointed out, a synthetic humanoid being, like an artificial human, and a mutant, both of who are experiencing prejudice against them beforehand, who actually overcome the prejudices and the self-doubts that they have, and there's incredible self-doubts in the sort of early parts of their relationship, to actually come together and, they get married by a mortis, I don't know just how legal that is, but I actually think it's one of the great romance stories of the Marvel Universe, overcoming oppression and prejudice and, the belief of the public that there's something wrong with the nature of their relationship. And it shows that, that love conquers all in the end. And I think it's
a bit of a statement for interracial marriage.
I think so. I mean, obviously mutants have always, have always sort of represented anybody that's suffering oppression or prejudice, or whether it's racial or sexual or cultural or whatever. And I mean, the Vision is very much presented as inhuman when he first appears. And one of the great story arcs from his appearance in issue 57 through to when they get married in Giant Sized Avengers number 4 is his development into understanding what humanity is and his belief that deep down emotionally he is human. I think it's one of the best stories of that period of Avengers history.
And during this period, you also get the magnificent George Perez popping on as artist.
Oh, yes.
Magnificent stuff.
Well, this is the book that he really started to make a name for himself.
And now he is the Avengers artist.
I dispute that, but he's considered by many, probably by most, to be the number one Avengers artist.
Yeah. But who do you think it is?
John Buscema.
John Buscema is excellent.
He drew the book at different points over 4 decades. And I think especially that mid to late 60s period was, I think, the team of him, Roy Thomas as writer and Tom Palmer as inker, actually established just about everything that the Avengers would be from that point onwards. So I consider him the defining. And he drew Under Siege, the greatest Avengers story ever.
So Perez would be second?
Perez would be second.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Felix?
I pretty much agree. John Buscema is the definitive Avengers artist. George Perez, second or third, with maybe Don Heck thrown in there as well.
Oh, there you go.
And I'd also include John Byrne.
And Byrne, yeah.
Good John call. Byrne for his multiple runs on the book as well. Just fantastic.
After a 7-issue stint with Jerry Conway, we then get Jim Shooter beginning writing.
A controversial figure.
He's controversial, but he's got an awesome blog.
He does.
Check out his blog, people. It's great
www.jimshooter.com.
Yeah, good stuff. Which has some classic adventures, including the Bride of Ultron, the Faria trilogy, And so one of my personal favourites, the Korvac Saga. With his run, we also get some new members, the Beast.
Yep.
Wonder Man resurrects. And Falcon and Ms. Marvel.
The Falcon. The
former partner of Captain America.
Yeah, the that's absolutely hilarious. The addition of the Falcon as basically tokenism.
That's right, because he also because Shoot also introduces Peter Gyrick, Peter Gyrick, who basically says that due to affirmative action laws,
they have to put
have to get the Falcon, on there.
Yeah, they give.
And he's not happy with it.
Isn't that David Michelinie?
No, it's Shooter.
Isn't it David Michelinie's first issue?
Yeah, I mean, Shooter set it all up.
Yeah,
so okay. That makes sense.
We'll go with that.
But I think Michelinie scripted the first issue. But
yeah, and Hawkeye's not happy at all.
No. At least it's very humorous.
To his credit, Falcon's not happy either.
No. Well, the government intervention in the Avengers lineup actually kind of annoys everybody. It's a great little subplot that carries through that period of the team.
Then we also get Henry Pym's breakdown and his constant identity problems and inferiority complex, which then leads to the infamous beating of his wife, the Wasp.
It's actually...
Never read it, so I can't actually comment, but...
Well, it's interesting. Jim Shooter, on the aforementioned blog, actually says that the artist on the issue, Bob Hall, actually drew the scene incorrectly.
Yeah.
That it wasn't actually meant to
push her away.
Well, he was meant to sort of lash out a bit and accidentally hit her.
Yeah.
Whereas in the comic, it looks like he's just turned and punched her, like smack in the face. So
heavy backhand.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because it's part of... a rather interesting storyline that does draw on the history of the character. I mean, he has had issues with mind control. He's had issues with multiple personalities.
Mm-hmm.
He actually creates a whole other identity for himself as Yellow Jacket and doesn't even realize that Yellow Jacket and he are the same person.
Yep.
So you're talking multiple personality disorder.
The guilt at the creation of Ultron.
And all of that plays into this nervous breakdown that he has. Mm. The unfortunate part of it is that everything about the character is now defined by that one panel.
I think it's kind of sad that 20 years later, it's still referenced. Mm. It's like, I know time works differently in the Marvel Universe, but it's, I mean, okay, the man's, they've reconciled, he's apologised multiple times. It's like,
well, they've actually
it's not
gone
like
through...
he grew up one day thinking, I'm going to be a wife beater. Mm.
Well, multiple writers have actually gone through efforts to try to rebuild the character. Steve Englehart did it, I think, very well in the first sort of 25 or so issues of West Coast Avengers. He brings the character to the point where he's almost going to commit suicide until a character called Firebird comes and kind of stops him from doing it, and he rebuilds himself. Kurt Busiek, on his run in the late 90s, also... went through a lot of efforts to try to rebuild the character, but time and time again, new writers just keep going back to this one scene, this one moment in the character's history.
And domestic abuse is horrible. That's not
absolutely.
I mean, it's he's moved on. He's atoned. Wasps, you know, forgiving him, and you know, and like you said, it was drawn incorrectly anyway. It just wasn't really meant to happen that way anyway. So it's a shame. And now, you know, now that Wasp is dead, thanks to Siege. Oh, Siege. it's you know, it's not much we can do. But he's got to turn over a new leaf now. He's part of Avengers Academy and doing well. Oh, anyway, we're talking about Loki's a real person.
They are real. What are you saying here?
It's still real to me.
I am not reading biographies.
No.
This isn't a history of the world.
You are not. Then Stern pops on and develops some several major storylines, such as Ultimate Vision, in which Vision takes over the world's computer systems, which leads to West Coast Avengers.
It does indeed.
As mentioned. And also the mentioned greatest Avengers story of all time, Avengers Under Siege.
Oh, yeah.
Baron Zemo and the Masters of Evil.
It's sort of all right.
It's pretty stuff. Just the scene at the end with Captain America with his foot locker. It's just unbelievable.
You know, the mansion is destroyed, the team has been decimated, and it actually changes the structure of the Avengers completely. So it's an amazing story and some really great, powerful character moments, especially involving Captain America.
Yep.
And one of my personal favourite Captain America moments, I think a moment that just sums up the character perfectly, is, you know, all these horrible things are happening, and Cap's being forced to watch Mr. Hyde beat up the Black Knight and almost kill Jarvis and everything, and Baron Zemo's just waiting for him to break, and he just sits there stone-faced and says, you know, you'll get yours.
I'll remember this.
That's right. It's just...
And Zemo just turns away with a thought bubble and is like, will the man not break?
Yeah, just an absolutely brilliant moment in the book. And it's a book full of those kind of just great moments.
This leads to War on Olympus, where Zeus blames the team for Hercules' injuries and puts them on trial.
Oh, really? Roger Stern was just on fire at this point.
He was on fire. And then another favourite of mine, Heavy Metal, when the Super Adaptoid gets a whole bunch of other robot villains and to attack the team. Great stuff.
It's just unfortunate at that point that there's some editorial problems between Mark Gruenwald, Avengers editor, and Roger Stern, Avengers writer.
So Stern, before he left, introduced, like we said, Monica, the Photon, Star Fox, Hawkeye's wife, Mockingbird, a personal favourite of yours, Richard?
Yeah, I thought it was actually really cool that she was brought into the West Coast Avengers and that Hawkeye actually got married.
Yeah.
The ladies' man that
the
he is.
The ladies' man he is. She-Hulk and Tigra. Then we get John Byrne.
Byrne actually took over Avengers and West Coast Avengers.
Yeah.
His Avengers run is solid without being... I think anything great, but his West Coast Avengers stories were fantastic.
With the visions and the Scarlet Witch's children turned out to be magical illusions.
Well, basically the entire run is centered around the Scarlet Witch, and just breaking her down slowly and surely, and just stripping her. Yeah, you know, first of all, the Vision gets kidnapped and reprogrammed, so he loses his emotions.
That cool white version.
Then the children that they had are revealed to not be real. Yeah.
Although they are now, aren't they?
Yeah, well, the
Wiccan and
Speed from the Young Avengers are apparently now... She used her reality powers to take their souls and put them into the bodies of these two other people.
Not their souls.
So she just kidnapped two people and put someone else's souls in there.
But that makes the Scarlet Witch more interesting now, don't you understand? It fully grounds her character and makes her likeable and gets fans to...
We'll get to Disassembled in a minute. But, so he slowly breaks her down over the course of about 12 or 14 issues to build up to this, what would have been, from the sounds of things, an absolutely amazing story in which it's revealed that the Avengers never actually existed, and so therefore Kang actually conquers the Earth in his first appearance. And so there was going to be a point in Byrne's run where suddenly reality changes and... It's a post-apocalyptic world and nobody remembers because basically Kang has conquered everything.
I love alternate realities.
I just want to point out something here. So from what you're saying so far, there has never been a bad Kang story.
Oh, we'll get to that. It's called The Crossing.
I should just point out that Kang is my personal favourite Avengers villain.
Oh, there you go.
Well,
the Avengers titles were then embroiled in the major crossover event, Acts of Vengeance, where Loki assembles many of Marvel's arch-villains.
Well, that's the other major storyline that Byrne did during his run. And
yeah.
That was a lot of fun. I enjoyed Acts of Vengeance.
I really like Acts of Vengeance. I've got it in hardcover down on my shelf.
I like the idea of seeing villains fighting heroes they wouldn't normally fight.
Mm.
So it's a nice, sort of just interesting little story to do. Just really, it was really just one or two issues per book. So
yeah, that was good. And of course, Byrne leaves. Bob Harris and Steve Epting take over.
Which features some really nice artwork and some... questionable story decisions at times.
Questionable. I think it's one of the weakest periods.
There are some good stories in that period, but for the most part it is pretty weak. And there was very much an attempt by Bob Harris to make the Avengers more like the X-Men.
Yeah.
Which the X-Men being, of course, the big franchise at the time. So there was an attempt to kind of make the Avengers into that, which...
It just didn't work.
It didn't really work for the
We get some new members, Cersei, Crystal, and Quicksilver, Hercules, and the Vision all come back. And Black Knight, of course, sorry. He was leading, I believe.
That's correct.
You
also get some less memorable characters during that
just
period.
Just some poor stories. Like the whole Death Cry thing. Terrible.
Magdalene, the alternate reality swordsman. There's some weird stuff going on in that period. And
then all of that culminates in the Operation Galactic Storm. A 19-part storyline, which ran through all the Avengers titles.
Yeah, it's 19 parts. It could have probably been at least half that, really.
It's 18 issues of crap, and maybe one issue of okay. Awful,
and it does result
stuff.
In the Avengers actually killing somebody, which was...
The Supreme Intelligence, killed by Iron Man.
Yeah, which was quite.
And Captain America's like, what the hell is going on here?
It's an interesting. But once again, it was an attempt to make the books darker and grittier and.
And culminated in the dark and gritty Force Works.
So just like to point out, though, Tony Stark, you know, murders someone, never gets mentioned. And this gets back to what you're saying about Yellow Jacket.
Yeah.
Whereas Yellow Jacket has been hounded by a single incident, and there's been no attempt. It gets back to what you were saying. No attempt to allow him to feel redeemed or.
That's right. I mean, Tony Stark's revealed to be mind controlled at this point.
It is. Later on in The Crossing, it's revealed that he was mind controlled.
In The Crossing.
Well, The Crossing.
Terrible.
What can you say about The Crossing other than that at that point it was the single worst Avengers story ever written?
So that's pretty much the early history of the Avengers up until like 400-ish when you get, you know, The Crossing, the worst Avengers story ever. Then, of course, you have when Marvel goes into Event Overdrive and you have Heroes Reborn, Heroes Return, Avengers Disassembled, which I'm going to go past quickly before Richo gets really upset. New Avengers, Mighty Avengers, Dark Avengers, and the Heroic Age. And I think now we're in Shattered or something like that. Shattered Heroes or the post-Fear itself.
Just briefly, the Heroes Reborn was an attempt to get A-list creators onto the book to try and save Marvel from bankruptcy.
Yeah, so by this time the Avengers, the image people have gone off. And, yeah.
Really, the Avengers book is an absolute disaster.
It's a shocker.
Fortunately, once those 12 issues are done, they do Heroes Return, which leads to the Kurt Busiek, George Perez run on Avengers, which is just seminal.
Avengers Volume 3.
And this is where I really became an Avengers fan, because it's the first instance where I'd read them consecutively, month after month, and was absolutely gobsmacked by it.
You also get to Avengers Forever, which I think is
Avengers Forever is just a... once again, one of the seminal Avengers stories. Just brilliant stuff. And certainly probably the best Kang story. And, And then, unfortunately, they then decide to get a writer called Chuck Austin onto the book, which is disaster.
Guy can't write the Avengers.
Well, actually, first it was Geoff Johns before Chuck Austin.
And Johns set up some really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
But he kind of left to be DC's number one guy, so... Yeah, and then we got Disassembled.
Bendis jumps on with Disassembled.
Yeah. Which equals The Crossing as the worst Avengers story ever written.
I actually don't mind Disassembled all that much.
it's an awful, awful story.
You just don't like it because of Scarlet Witch becomes a bad guy.
No, it's not that. Or a bad girl. I don't like it because none of the characters in it are actually acting in character.
But then
there are also some very strange credits, like Hawkeye's death in that.
Yeah. They completely...
It should be a big, dramatic, heroic moment. You know, he's down to his last arrow. All hope lies in his hands. But is that, oh no, my arrows are going... flaring up. They're going to explode. Here, I'll jump on the back of whatever alien he's jumping on and we'll go and blow up the ship. As opposed to, you know, getting, say, Captain America's shield, tying his quiver to it, slinging the shield into the ship. Oh my God, we've just saved humanity. And Hawkeye's still alive.
Or alternatively, he could just... take his quiver off.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I mean.
It was a rushed story designed to get them to New Avengers. Mm. And look, it worked. Because from that point onwards, from New Avengers onwards, the Avengers became the number one Marvel franchise. It overtook the X-Men. Yeah,
that's the irony. One of the worst stories ever written and drawn in the Avengers history elevated the Avengers to the top franchise in the comics industry.
All right, so New Avengers, as you mentioned, after House of M... you get some new members: Luke Cage, Wolverine, Ronan, Spider-Man, Spider-Woman, and the incredibly annoying Sentry.
Oh yes.
Oh, terrible. And then of course you get Civil War, which is a major event in the Marvel Universe.
Also rubbish.
Civil War is actually pretty good.
No, Civil War is a series of snapshots and once again characters doing stupid things for no reason other than they need to do it in order to progress the plot. And it's the kind of writing where the plot determines the characters rather than the characters driving the plot.
Okay. Moving on, jeez. After that, you can't really go past that. Which has a whole bunch of new people, and it's a pretty major event, which then leads to Mighty Avengers and so on and so forth. So, I mean, we won't go over that again, but basically just a whole bunch of new... And it's where we are at the moment with the Avengers being one of the top books.
Well, it's the franchise book for Marvel. It's the book that determines exactly what's happening in the entire universe.
Multiple spin-offs, Avengers the Initiative, Avengers Academy,
Dark Avengers, New Avengers,
which doesn't exist anymore.
Mighty Avengers.
So Avengers Academy is still going.
Dark Avengers is actually starting again in a few
restarting
months.
Young Avengers still going.
Avengers the Next Generation.
Yeah, well, that's what Young Avengers is. So you basically got like the former sidekicks and stuff.
Yeah, it's
like
pretty
that.
Much just an Avengers fest at the moment, and yeah, it's just unfortunate that
and it's
in
not
going
to end now. The movie was huge. Yeah.
It's just unfortunate that in order to turn Avengers into the number one Marvel franchise, that they've completely removed all the things that made the Avengers what they were to begin with.
We're running out of time, but I do want to mention a couple of the alternate Avengers teams, alternate universe Avengers teams. You've got the 1950s Avengers, Avengers Next, that alternate future timeline, MC2, Marvel Zombies, House of M Avengers, and a non-powered group of Avengers in the Age of Apocalypse. But we've also got the most important ones, which are the Ultimates, the flagship team of the Ultimate Marvel Universe, led by Nick Fury, and is essentially what the film is based on. Pretty much the film is based on the Ultimate sort of a version of the team. They're pretty impressive to start off with. They've gotten a bit ordinary now, but when they first started off, it was a groundbreaking story and a lot of fun. Obviously, we're fans, so let's just finish off with a bit of fan service. Our preferred Avengers lineup.
I actually have my favourite Avengers lineup does actually appear in issues of the comic, most specifically Avengers Annual 10.
Right.
It's a classic story by Chris Claremont and Michael Golden that actually introduces Rogue of the X-Men. But basically, for me, all Avengers teams need to feature Captain America, Iron Man, and Thor as your key three characters, followed by the Vision, the Scarlet Witch, and Hawkeye. Those are your top six. And then this personal favourite team of mine also includes the Beast, who I don't think was any better than when he was with the Avengers, and Wonder Man. So that's my classic Avengers lineup right there from Avengers Annual 10, 1980.
Nice. Look.
Yeah. I agree with the six that Richo says.
Yeah.
But I'd have Cap, Thor, Iron Man, Hawkeye, Vision, Scarlet Witch. And then I'd have four reserve members. Wonder Man being the powerhouse. And I would put the Beast, or maybe the Beast and or Hank Pym, the Black Panther or the Black Widow. And then a fourth member of your own choice.
Oh, geez. Mine's going to be pretty piddly in comparison. I go with the classics, of course. Captain America, Iron Man, Thor. Vision, got to be on there. Ms. Marvel, just because I think she's a bit of a powerhouse and a cool character. And, of course, Spider-Man, because I love him. And just because for his, for like you said, the urban stuff, so the ground sort of stuff. And Wonder Man. Because Wonder Man, basically, back in the day, was Sentry. So before Sentry came along.
Yeah.
And ruined it for everybody.
He was Sentry, but interesting.
Yeah. So it's, back when it was...
But
it was
no Scarlet Witch. I'm never going to forgive you.
I'm sorry. I put Vision on there. Was that...
Yeah, look, that's okay. And no Hawkeye.
Sorry?
And you didn't put Hawkeye in either.
Hawkeye, I think, is cool. Don't get me wrong. And I really wish on the movie we'd had Boxing Glove Arrow Hawkeye. That would be bad. I don't know. If you've got Spidey, you don't really need Hawkeye.
I'm sorry.
He's not going to give up Spidey.
I know. No, he's not going to give up Spidey.
And I'm probably the same with Batman and the Justice League, but the Avengers is different to the Justice League. Justice League sort of revolves around having your top tier characters in.
I didn't put him in there because he's a top tier character. I put him in there because he's all round. I mean, he can cover a lot of facets. The scientist, the fighter, long range attacks.
Okay, and more importantly, to stop an argument that could stay for half an hour, I'll just jump in with my team.
Oh, cool.
Leonardo, Donatello, and Raphael.
Hey, I like that team.
John Steed, Mrs. Peel.
Tiger,
and on that
Chitara.
Note, that's the Avengers wrap-up.
Lino.
Thanks, guys. Let's move on to Coming Soon. Okay, on May 3rd is Jason Statham's latest movie, Safe, where he tries to keep a 10-year-old girl safe from people who are trying to get after her. Jason Statham, I love the man, but he's got to get some different stuff.
Isn't this just like Hostage?
Who knows?
Witness, but without the Amish.
He's awesome, but he's seriously, please. Disney re-released their classic Beauty and the Beast in 3D.
Because John Carter did make any money, and they've got to recoup their losses somehow.
I love Beauty and the Beast. It's probably my favourite Disney movie, but I just can't stand this 3D stuff.
No.
I'm over it so much. Yeah. And I'll just watch the Blu-ray that I've got on my show.
I think it's not going... Because it's not 3D rendered animation, it's cell animation. It's just going to look like, you know, cell animation... Just the immediate foreground characters in the foreground, the immediate background characters in the background.
Exactly.
There's not going to be no dimensionality.
And there's actually got a scene that is practically 3D anyway. So the ballroom scene, is as close to 3D as you're going to get without actually being 3D.
Yeah, that's
perfectly
glasses.
Fine. You don't need that chandelier in your face.
No.
Chandelier in your face? Oh no.
But it's a good, cheap way to make money.
Oh yeah.
By releasing the clothes. Like Titanic, like Star Wars,
like
everything
I said earlier,
being done in 3D.
John Carter failed at the box office.
$200 million.
Which is a shame.
John Carter 3D.
John Carter was in 3D. Oh. It's a shame, because John Carter was actually pretty good. Then the week after, on May 10th, we get Tim Burton's big screen adaptation of Dark Shadows.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, which the NCP crew will be reviewing in the next episode. As well as sci-fi comedy Iron Sky, which involves Nazis invading from their secret moon base.
You know, for some reason, this idea appeals to me.
You were very excited during the preview.
I just love stupid stories. I mean, as a sci-fi fan, I love things like super intelligent gorillas and Nazis with bases on the moon, and you know, the really dumb old school stuff. And look, I'm sure this film will be terrible.
Yeah. It does look awful, but I want to see it.
But
still.
I'm kind of... Yeah, I do want to see it just because, you know, an evil Nazi base on the dark side of the moon is just something that appeals to me.
It looks like it's meant to be a bad 50s science fiction film. Yeah. It doesn't look like it's taking itself seriously in any... The special effects look okay. They've had some money pumped into it, into the production, sure. Hmm. But it's... You know, if you're going into it thinking this is going to be an all-out serious action adventure...
Which clearly not. I mean, if anybody's seen the trailer,
it is meant... You're meant to go and think it's silly.
I'm hoping for something like, say, Black Dynamite
or
Machete or, you know, something that's fun and silly and kind of paying homage to the past whilst being just really dumb but entertaining.
Entertaining, yeah.
And as always, NCP's favourite cinema, The Aster, is a great selection of films shown in the next 2 weeks, including a Charlie Chaplin Buster Keaton double, Modern Times and The General on May 6th.
Great stuff.
And a Sherlock Holmes double on the 9th, which are unfortunately the Guy Ritchie Sherlock Holmes films. Check out the full listings at www.astertheatre.net.au. So that's it for episode 23.
Don't forget you can contact us by email at feedback@nerdculturepodcast.com or post on our Facebook wall at www.facebook.com/nerdculturepodcast or tweet us at nerdculturecast or leave a comment on any post on our website www.nerdculturepodcast.com and don't forget to rate us and review us on iTunes and subscribe to the podcast.
Yay! So next episode we have Dust Jacket on Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card and Popcorn Junkie on Dark Shadows. Looking forward to that. That's it from me. And yes, my name is David. And that's
sure?
it from the crew. Richard.
Bye everybody.
Luke.
My name is Luke. I can't argue with that.
And Crystal.
I am not Luke's father.
That's good. That means there are no questions that I've got to ask.
Bye.
Bye.
Let's get to it. Bust a move. There's nothing to it.
You're strange.
I'm strange.
It's strangely alluring.
Alright.
Alright.
Oh yeah.
Alright.
Alright. Or as Jim Kelly wrote on my picture that I got signed, right on.
So Crystal, is it just me or has this episode just become a complete write-off before we start?
You know you want it, baby.